If you've been told to pull up your socks, then make sure it's a pair of TNT socks. The TNT shop is now open at TNTRadio.live. Hesh, Hesher Dude, Hesher McHesherton, El Hesherino, and Hesher the Magnificent.
Who calls him that?
Brian McClain is Hesher on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
That's right. Today's News Talk. I am Hesher. My name is Brian McClain. Thank you for being here with me today to break down some headlines and have some amazing conversations with some amazing guests. We're going to be speaking with Melanie Collette very soon here, and it's going to be a great conversation. A couple other great conversations to be had here. Also, TNTRadio.live is the website. Hop on over there, get yourself a pair of TNT socks, check out our What's On events calendar, and be sure and download the TNT Radio app. That's what I use to listen to TNT when I'm not broadcasting on TNT. Now, we know that Donald Trump will not be at the debates tonight, the GOP debates, but once again, he seems to have found something maybe a little bit better. You know, he's very good at the PR. So President Trump will deliver remarks to the United Auto Workers members tonight in Clinton Township, Michigan, during the Republican presidential primary debates in California. Trump's event will likely have more viewers and more impact on the campaign trail than the debate between, as Gateway Pundit puts it, you gotta love Gateway. Who wrote this? Jordan puts it this way, a debate between weak, boring GOP candidates. So we've got thousands of union members currently on strike asking for raises from the big three, General Motors, Stellantis, and Ford. Many reportedly fear that Joe Biden's green energy policies will lead to job loss. Well, duh, of course they will. Have you seen what these guys are doing with their policies? They want to bring in Chinese manufacturers. There's a big fight going on in Michigan about this Chinese company, Gotion, coming in and building EV batteries, which you and I both know are made, you know, mined. They use slaves. I don't know how else to say it. I don't know how to sugarcoat it. They use this huge range of people, very young as 7 years old from some of the reports I've seen, literally using pickaxes, wearing t-shirts and flip-flops in dirt holes to pull lithium and stuff like this out of the earth. It's just ridiculous. Now, here's a disturbing one. A 95-year-old veteran became homeless after his nursing home room was given to an illegal alien. Now, I'm a little bit careful with headlines like this one because we saw some of these back when Title 42 was sunsetted. And some of them turned out to be conspiracy candy, but I think that those ended up being conspiracy candy for, to turn people off, to take people off of the scent, because these kind of things are happening. And this one, we have a name and everything. Frank Tamarano, a Korean War veteran, was told to leave his nursing home room at Island Shores Senior Residence to make room for an illegal alien. I don't know how this works, what the logistics are. Isn't he or someone in his family paying for that? I really don't understand it. But here's a quote from Tamarano. The thing I'm annoyed about is how they did it. It was very disgraceful what they did to the people in Island Shores. Then one day there was a notice on the board. I think they gave us a month and a half to find out where we were going to go, he said. I thought my suitcases were going to be on the curb because I'm not that fast. So luckily, this man's daughter came in and scooped him up and, you know, helped him out. But you got to wonder who did not have, maybe, you know, some people don't have that family to come help him out. This is very, very bad here. And then, you know, also yesterday we talked about life-saving drugs. And now what's going on with the FDA? Well, the power of big government bureaucrats at the Food and Drug Administration was felt by millions of Americans during the last pandemic, scamdemic, some might say. And yet the Congress has quietly given the FDA even greater authority to ban life-saving drugs that don't fit their preferred narratives. So earlier this year, Congress snuck in a 19-line section into the 2023 Omnibus Appropriations Bill, which, by the way, was 4,155 pages. Did you get to read that? I did not get to read that. I tend to wonder if my representatives and senators actually read it either. Spending $1.7 trillion with a T, that will change the way medicine is practiced. So, you know, the FDA, what are you doing? Government regulatory agencies, what are you doing? Stop lying to us. Stop stealing our tax dollars and stop allowing government and big pharma to run roughshod over us. This is not what is supposed to be happening in our country. Now, don't miss out on a thing. As I mentioned earlier, be sure and download the TNT Radio app from either the Apple App Store or Google Play so you can easily listen live to us anywhere, anytime. That app is available to download right now, and it'll help keep you up to speed on TNT Radio.
Gaining perspectives.
It's well-balanced conversation.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
All right. Well, we are joined by Melanie Collette. It's great to see you, Melanie, and I'm really appreciating the fact that you're joining me here today on the Brian McClain Show. Now, I have a headline here I want to ask you about. Black conservatives join legal brief in U.S. Supreme Court case against racist admissions practices at schools in elite Northern Virginia STEM schools. So we've seen a lot of this kind of stuff going on over the last, oh, I don't know, year or so, 18 months. We've seen some Supreme Court cases that were, I thought, pretty clear in this regard. But hey, this seems to be the day and age in which the Supreme Court says something, and then all of these other places across the United States try to figure out how to buck back against it. Can you fill me in? What's going on here?
So what's going on is this school in Fairfax School District decided it would be an awesome idea to target Black students for the STEM program. And they did it in such a way that they were only asking Black students to enter the STEM program and thus racially discriminating against other students. And you cannot do that because we have a 14th Amendment. And so we are going to court to fight this. We're fighting a couple of things. We're fighting racial discrimination in general, because this kind of policy really promotes racism. And that is our very strong feeling about that. And we very strongly believe that, listen, when we say we don't discriminate based on race, when we say we don't want applications based on race, which is what we ask for when we ask for equality, we never asked for equity as a people. That was never a thing, and it's never legal. We asked for equality. And so what you don't do is put policies in place asking kids to enter a program and exclude other races. You don't do that. It's not good for anyone. It's a slippery slope. And that's why we're submitting this brief to support the abolishment of that policy.
It's absolutely ridiculous. I mean, why would we not want all of our students? We're at a time in our nation right now where we need as many students in STEM classes as possible. I mean, our reading comprehension is tanking. Never mind math and science and all this other stuff. I mean, it's really sad, the ranking that American students now have worldwide. I mean, are we just virtue? What are they trying to do here in Virginia? They're just signaling us into oblivion.
On a more insidious note, well, they're certainly virtue signaling, but on a more insidious note, what schools are doing is messaging to Black and brown kids that they are not as smart as their counterparts of other races. And that is, in my opinion, not so humble opinion, the best way to keep an entire people down, the most racist way to keep an entire people from actually moving forward, is to constantly message to them that without the almighty hand of the white man, you cannot succeed. That's what that's saying. If we don't directly invite Black kids and exclude other kids, thus eliminating competition, because Black kids, after all, wouldn't be able to hack it if there were fair competition, that's the best way to control those minds and hearts and thus their votes and thus keep power, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm on a more insidious note, that's what they're doing. On a happier note, they're virtue signaling and trying to make white people who feel guilty about being white feel less guilty about being white and successful, and also signaling to Black people that we are absolutely your friend when they really are not.
And what about, you know, this doesn't even need to be a black and white conversation. What about Asian students? What about Latino students? What about mixed race students? I mean, there's so many different, you know, races and creeds of people. What does it say to those kids?
That's exactly right. And what I would like to see, crux of the lawsuit involves the disenfranchisement of Asian students. And what I would really like to see, nobody wants to say this, but I will, because why not? Is why, if we're looking at groups of successful students, perhaps what we need to look at are the habits of those students and not the color of their skin. Because I can assure you that if certain groups of students are successful, they have very similar habits.
And what about their families? Is there something to be said about maybe the status of their family, their mom
That's
and dad,
exactly,
hopefully, or lack
that
thereof?
That is 150%.
One?
Absolutely. That's 150% right. But nobody wants to have that conversation because now you're just being mean. But are you being mean when you're looking at the habits and culture of one group and how successful they are in education, and you're looking at the success and habits of another group and saying that they are not as successful? And why is that? And again, it's not about skin color. I was having this discussion with a friend the other day, and he's one of these people that believes as a black man, he can't make it in America. One of those people. And I said, well, what about our Nigerian brothers and sisters? They seem to do quite well. And I said, and do you want to know why? Look at their habits. Look at their culture. I said, you know why? Because education and success and self-efficiency is very important in their culture.
So sorry, I don't mean to interrupt, but are you telling me they're not taught that they are victims from the time they're little children? Because that seems
they
like that
not.
Would make a big difference.
That's exactly right. Their parents are not teaching them that. Their families are not teaching them that. Their families and their parents and their philosophies, their philosophical views as a culture is that of brilliance and success. And that is why, as a culture and as a group, they tend to be successful. So again, I say to you, why would you take a Nigerian child and put them in an American public school and tell them that, well, due to your history of racism, you're going to fail?
Yeah.
What
that-
if...
That's
we
bad.
Instilled, instead of victimhood, victory and resilience, because that is in our history as well. What if we emphasize that instead?
Right. And why not maybe a little bit of civics, a little bit of U.S. history that's not so watered down, and just stop giving us the emotional version of history. Start teaching civics again. I mean, do we teach kids in school these days? I know some do, but on a whole, do we teach them civics? Do we teach them pride in national pride or anything like this?
I'm a recovering high school teacher. I used to.
Oh, good.
An adjunct professor. I used to teach economics, computer applications, as well as accounting and financial literacy and other business technology classes. And I can tell you that they're not big on civics. One of my favorite classes to teach was business law, because I did get the opportunity to teach the Constitution and explain why civics is so important and why your vote is so important. But more important than that, being an informed voter is very important and how it directly affects your life.
Oh, 100%. And what do you think about how social media has played into this? I'm a big critic of the mass media cartel and the social media technocrats, because I feel like they've created sort of a feedback loop that really harms not just kids, kind of all of us.
It's an echo chamber. And, you know, if you're not careful, your kids will totally get sucked in. And just the impression that people have of different cultures and different people. At one point in my 24-year education career, I worked in a predominantly white school. There weren't very many kids there who looked like me. And one of the students said to me, one of the white students said to me, sometimes I really wish I was black, because it seems like black people are so cool and they have so much fun all the time. That's social media. Now, I can't speak for other black folks, but that has not been my experience.
Yeah.
It is not constant fun and popping bottles and having parties. I've worked very hard in my 53 years on this earth. So, but it just goes to show these impressions and these stereotypes. And quite honestly, in my mind, I don't think that that child growing up is going to take any Black person very seriously, because that's what you think our lives are like.
Oh, yeah, that's a huge problem. It's like, and you can see it because of the way advertising and casting and the entertainment industry has shifted. You know, I just want good content. I want good content, believable characters, role models, you know, this kind of thing. And that can come in all shades and styles. But it's like, I think you're onto something there. They've done a bit of, not just a bit, they've done a wave of psychological operations on our youth.
That's 150% right. And they're just indoctrinating. They're indoctrinating us as a people. They're indoctrinating us and pulling the Jedi mind trick on us, making us think that they're our friends when all they are doing is keeping us down and killing our babies as much as possible for socioeconomic reasons. So helpful. You know what would be helpful? If the 63 million babies that have been killed since Roe v. Wade were still here, that would have helped Black people a whole lot, because there'd be more of us.
Amen. I'm going to leave it at that, because I don't know what else needs to be said, seeing as we're out of time. Those are great final words. Melanie Collette, find her at nationalcenter.org. Melanie, thank you so much for joining me here on TNT Radio.
TNT Radio's Ross Cameron.
So after the first dam failed, you then saw the release of 1.5 million cubic meters of water rushing towards the city of Derma. And so we're now attempting to count the dead, and it's very difficult to know, but it's clear that at least 20,000 people have perished. Their bodies continue to wash up on the shores. I saw one bloke interviewed who had lost 11 members of his family in one night, including his 8-month-old son, wife, and children. You know, as Australia tears itself apart over whether or not to create a 122nd Aboriginal bureaucracy in Canberra, some countries have real problems.
Ross Cameron on TNT Radio.
Affordable housing, we can build that. Sustainable housing, we can build that. At MIT Modular, we understand the importance of housing for all and the importance of design, cost, and functionality. Our goal is to meet the needs of our growing population by converting shipping containers to livable units. If you're like-minded and in a position to invest in something meaningful and life-changing, we want to hear from you. We are a team of professional architects, engineers, and financial and tax experts dedicated to offering unique solutions that provide a brighter future. Our Opportunity Zone Fund offers investors both real estate and operating business diversification, 5-year tax deferral on capital gains, annual tax benefits, and ultimately tax-free appreciation potential. There are Opportunity Zones all over America. If you're interested in learning more about our services, need affordable housing, or want to participate in creating a new vision for tomorrow, give us a call in the U.S. on 385-985-5702. Or read more at mitmodular.com. MIT Modular. We can build that.
Well, I want to say this, and I'm going to say it just once.
This is today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
For the past 37 years, my next guest has litigated against the federal bureaucracy, winning over and over again. Ron Paul calls my next guest an expert in constitutional theory and history and an expert litigator with a long string of legal victories over the federal bureaucracy. One of my favorite federal regulatory bureaucratic agencies to rip on is the FDA. So I'm very pleased to have Jonathan Amore joining us once again. Welcome back, sir.
Great to be with you.
It's great to see you. So tell me, I'm going to jump right into it. How is the Senate race going? How is the campaign going? What can you tell us?
Well, very well. I mean, we have volunteers all across the state. We just had a fundraiser in Utah, kind of a unique thing. It's a telethon, reached about 2.5 million people, and the donations are still coming in. It's been phenomenal. So we're really looking forward to taking on Tim Kaine, and I think we're going to end up being the nominee. Everything's pointing in that direction, and we certainly don't plan any changes in our approach. So I think we're going to be there.
Excellent. Well, you know, I've talked about it before, and I look at it every time I speak with you. You know, I look at the initiatives on your website, and they're just bang on. They're bang on. And I got to go straight to this one, the Secure Borders Initiative. My goodness, we're seeing just a surge lately, an absolute surge, and not just a surge on our southern border, from people coming across multiple borders. This is just blowing my mind. People going across 4, 5, 6, 7 different countries' borders to get to our border and then all let in. But we also have the airports being jammed. We've got people from 160 countries coming here. We've got 2 to 5 million new people here, tens of thousands of missing children that they can't keep track of, and now these huge problems happening in our cities with fentanyl and drugs and all this. I mean, what's your take on what's going on with the border lately?
Well, I just came back from the border. I spent a good long day there, entire day there, and with the CBP chief, CBP chief there. And I investigated all aspects of their operations, border operations done by the cartels. And I can tell you this, that we have created such an enormous incentive for people to come across, and we have moved the CBP defenses away from the border to human processing. So we're actually aiding and abetting this whole movement to get people into the country who are illegal, to the extent that in the human processing centers, they keep them there for 72 hours and they give each family $3,000. And they also sign them up for food stamps and sign them up for welfare and indicate how they can get free education and free medical care. And then they ship them off by bus to plane airports, train stations and bus terminals, depending on where they want to go. And then there are government funded by grant NGOs that pay their bus fare, pay their plane fare, pay for the trains to ship them all over the United States. And this is a massive movement. And then when you look at the border, they used to, in the one area I was in, they had 5 patrols before Biden. They now have 1 patrol, and it's an area of something like 50 miles for 1 truck. And they're just coming across the border in droves, and there's no limitation. There's no meaningful effort whatsoever to stop drug traffickers, sex traffickers, MS-13 gangs, 18th Street gangs, Bloods, Crips. So they're all just pouring into the nation, destroying property, going after kids. I mean, it's criminal, and the government is privy to it. They've turned over America's immigration policy to the criminal cartels. It's very apparent.
Yeah, and these cartels, this is something we've been talking about lately with a number of our guests. It's really becoming crystallized in my vision that when we're talking about cartels, a lot of the American public kind of has this Hollywood version in their head of what that means. They're not actually thinking about these cartels as more of a piece of the governments than anything. I mean, they have so much sway over government in not just in Mexico, but in many South American countries. So, I mean, what about
that?
And
they're pretty brutal. They're brutal, yes. Institutions, and they're victimizing all these people who are coming across. There's a District 18 gap in the San Diego border area. We were there, and in that gap, just days before we were right there, 2 people who crossed the border, 2 illegal entrants, failed to pay the cartels the full freight, and they were executed on American territory by operatives of the cartels. One of them was killed. The other one was injured and was picked up by the authorities on the American side. But 8 others were killed on the Mexican side, and their bodies were put in acid vats where their bodies are disintegrated and their bones are just pitched out. This is what they do to show them that if you don't pay them what they demand, they're going to kill you. And they terrorize these people. They rape the women. They abuse them. They force them into illicit trafficking and drug trade so that they can continue to profit after they get into the United States. I mean, we are aiding and abetting a massive sex trafficking and drug trafficking trade brought about through the southern border with the full complicity of the Biden administration.
It's a lot for many of us to take in, I think, in this country. And I think that there are more people waking up to it, more people listening to TNT radio and, you know, the very small handful of other outlets out there that are willing to speak with people like yourself. I'm going to bring a headline in here, but when we come back, I'd like to ask you about your constituency, the people in your state, how they feel about this and all that. So hold the line. This is today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Now, TNT Radio News.
Uh-oh. Scandal. Huge news. This is very important.
This is James O'Neill with a check of today's headlines. U.S. soldier Travis King is set to be expelled from North Korea after spending 2 months in custody, according to state media reports released on Wednesday. The North Korean news agency KCNA has announced King's impending removal from the country, citing his illegal entry in July when he broke away from a tour group visiting the DMZ and made a dash for the communist nation. About 20 people have been taken into custody following widespread looting incidents that erupted in Philadelphia last night. One woman even live-streamed the chaos.
God, you're amazing. You're a much better listener than my wife. You're always there for me. I think I may be in love.
Where is she?
Well, it's not what it seems. I was talking to...
Who's the tramp I heard you talking to?
That was my Alexa, sweetie.
Well, she sounds like a tramp.
Fall in love with news and talk all over again with your smart device. Just tell it to play.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Speaking with Jonathan Immord here for U.S. Senate. Immord for VA.com is the website. You can look at all the wonderful endorsements, the vision, the initiatives, the events upcoming, all the great stuff, even contribute to the campaign over there. Now, Jonathan, what do you think about, what are you hearing from your fellow citizens in VA? Are they concerned about the border? And how's this affecting, places in your state?
So everywhere I go, I hear about the border from our people. In fact, the governor has said that Virginia is truly a border state because the amount of fentanyl coming in and the amount of sex trafficking and drug trafficking in this state. It is absolutely the case that in every suburban area, we have MS-13 gang people who are from the south of the border who've come across illegally, and they are infiltrating everything from the schools where sex trafficking is happening in the schools. In fact, I'm a constitutional lawyer, and I represent two families whose children, one 12 and one 14, were sex trafficked within the Fairfax County public school system, the largest school system in the state, 181,000 kids. And this with the school system essentially looking the other way. And in fact, the school system admitted in 2021 that sex trafficking is happening in every high school in the Fairfax County public school system and in many middle schools and in some grade schools. So it's an absolutely devastating problem that's very real. And in addition to that, you know, the issues that are confronting the people are, yes, the schools, the whole transitioning nonsense, which is happening in the schools here too. And also biological males entering girls and women's sports and locker rooms. People are appalled. Their kids are at risk all the time now in the schools. They don't like the fact that their children are being taught from preschool all the way through high school, that their genders are fluid, and that they celebrate them when they announce that their gender is different from their sex, their biological sex. This whole thing is sick. The whole environment with CRT, critical race theory, where it's a Marxist indoctrination based on racism. They are appalled that the racism is being taught to their kids. So I would say the parents' issues are number one for people on a day-to-day basis. The second issue is definitely crime. See an uptick all throughout Virginia of crime. People are worried about the border effects of to crime. And they're also worried about the Soros-backed prosecutors who refuse to prosecute, the anti-incarceration prosecutors, who there are many in this state. So they look for answers, and we have answers for them, and they appreciate that. Most candidates, of course, don't provide specific answers. They're big on what the problems are, but they don't provide the answers. Our campaign's different in that we provide the answers. And probably the reason for that is that's the reason why I'm running. I want to solve the problems, right? That's why I'm doing this.
Yeah, well, I noticed on your website you also talk about completing the border wall. I mean, talk about it used to be such a huge topic in the Trump years. And then, you know, I guess once the stupid COVID thing happened, it was just like, oh, we just can't afford that. That will always stick in my mind, sir. Well, we can't afford that. We can't do that. But here's $7 trillion while we lock you in your house and destroy your business and mask your kid and, you know, try to get you to take these experimental gene therapies that we're going to rename a vaccine. I mean, how important is the border wall? And I noticed that's like number one on your list there. So talk to me a little bit about the physical security.
Well, there are three things that are important to solve this problem in the border. One is the border wall, without question. When you go down there, as I did, and you see the gaps created in the border wall, and you know that every night, that is where a huge number of people come through, you come to the quick realization that at least it provides a deterrent. And the border walls are not an absolute barrier, but they're a very significant barrier. They slow them down. So you need also the patrols. We got to get back to defending our nation. We need the patrols. So there are three things I would do. We can't rely on Department of Homeland Security. It is layers thick with open borders people, open society people who are reflective of George Soros's thinking and Alejandro Mayorkas. They don't believe in a United States of America. They believe in an open society in which everybody is part of this global community and they don't want borders. So you can't have them running it, but they're there and they're layers thick and they won't leave after the election. Mayorkas will, but not all these other bureaucrats. So what do we do? One, border wall. Two, block grants to the border states to enable the border states to hire more police and more National Guard to police. So we have much more policing by the states that have an interest in it. We do it under Article 1, Section 10 of the Constitution, which enables them to invoke war power, essentially. They can arrest, detain, and kick the people out who are illegal, all on their own without the feds. That's the second thing. Third thing is we make it absolutely prohibited for anyone to seek asylum by coming into the United States illegally. You come into the United States illegally seeking asylum, and you cannot ever have asylum. You can never become an American citizen if you do that. The only way you could do it is by going to the United States Embassy in your country of origin and applying, or in an adjacent country other than the United States to the U.S. Embassy there and applying. There's absolutely no reason why. I talked to one guy at the border wall who's from Ecuador, and I asked him, why don't you apply for asylum in your country of origin in Ecuador through to the United States Embassy? He said, it just takes too much time. It's paperwork. I can come in here much faster by coming up it to the border wall and coming in this way. And I will go where I want to go. And then in addition, he said, I asked him, where do you want to go? He said, oh, Manhattan, as if they need more illegal immigration in Manhattan. So yeah. And he'll get there. Let me tell you, they'll bring him in. He'll stay in a human processing center for no more than 72 hours. They will give him money. They will give him all of those things, welfare, food stamps, trip to the bus station, plane station, or the train. And he'll go to Manhattan. When he gets there, they'll pay for the trip. When he gets there, there'll be NGOs on the other side. They'll take care of him. Now, you know, this is the kind of thing that is a total destruction in the United States. And that's what they want. So those are the three things to solve it. And and I work hard to implement every single one of those things in the United States Senate.
Yeah. It's such a, to me, it feels like this is it. You know, I've said the same thing about COVID, but I still kind of feel like that's it because they've set up a industrial complex around the idea of viruses and pandemics. And now they've set up an industrial complex around the idea of asylum seekers. And, you know, it's like, again, some of these people are going across 4, 5, 6 borders. I mean, why not? Aren't you supposed to seek asylum at the next country? I mean, what kind of, I'll finish you up with this question. I got about 1.5 minutes left. What kind of political policies between Washington, D.C. and Mexico and so on and so forth down into Southern America are in place that say, hey, yeah, just bring them on through, truck them right through your country, because this is causing chaos and damage through all the countries that these people travel through also.
All the agreements that President Trump had with Mexico and with other states in South America that were designed to stop this have been obliterated by this administration. They have done everything possible to open the doors of the United States to anybody who wants to come in. And as your point at the start of the show, there are overwhelming numbers of foreign nationals coming from the Middle East, China, and from Eastern Europe, and you know, from the former Soviet states, as well as from countries that are definite enemies of ours, like Iran and North Korea. So this is insane. We are opening the door to foreign agents to come into this country and wreak havoc. The consequences of this, of allowing terrorists in, for example, this is going to affect us for decades. And wait, we are sitting on a ticking time bomb. We are going to see something horrible happen because of this. And I'm afraid to say, but that indeed is the case, because they're allowing terrorists in, and they've allowed them in for over 2 years.
Yeah, the numbers are insane. Even without that factor, just the sheer number of humanity coming here with no intention of becoming Americans, no intention of taking on our culture, is absolutely insane. Sure, there's some that will, but it's not looking good. So we need people like you, sir. Jonathan Emord for U.S. Senate, emordfortva.com is the website. Sir, thank you very much for joining us here on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
They're back. The mRNA COVID jab is being pushed by corporations and governments around the world. But Alex Berenson says, don't take it.
From Washington, D.C., this is the Morano Minute with your host, TNT Radio's Mark Morano.
Former New York Times reporter and author of Pandemia, Alex Berenson, had this to say on Joe Rogan's show about the revival of the mRNA jab.
We do not know what the long-term effects of the mRNA vaccines are. And I would go beyond borderline. I would say it is immoral and unethical to keep using those. The mRNAs, at this point to me, they're a failed product, and they basically should be withdrawn.
Unknown side effects? Probably, putting it mildly. A failed shot? Putting it accurately. They won't stop pushing it, though. Too much has been invested, too many profits, too many egos are on the line. We need emergency power reform to ensure that these vaccine mandates never happen again on planet Earth. This is Mark Morano for the Morano Minute on TNT Radio.
Unlike other health concerns, mental illness is not always easy to see. Depression won't show up on an eye chart, and you won't find PTSD by looking at a thermometer. Sorting out a mental health concern takes professional diagnosis and treatment. Anxiety won't just go away under a bandage. If you or a loved one has a mental health concern, call 1-800-662-HELP for free and confidential information and treatment referral. Learn more at samhsa.gov/support.
Hear about it.
I don't even know where to start with AOC.
Talk about it.
The stupidity of this administration.
On today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
You got to wonder what is going on in this country when it comes to fires. We have seen so many. Let's see what's happened in Hawaii recently, Canada, California, just some staggering, amazing fire seasons. I started to really notice this back 2015, 16, 17, started to wonder what's going on, especially after I saw the town of Paradise burn down in California, not far from Chico. So, and there's so many questions about this. You know, obviously things like prescribed burns and, you know, these sort of things are being impacted by the green agenda, perhaps, maybe. But I've got an expert here to help me break this down. So I'd like to welcome you, Yale Osowski, to the show. Thanks for joining me. What is going on with all the fires?
Well, you know, it's a good question. It's kind of crazy how much we've had, at least in the news, and it's very present. And obviously, there's a big incentive to cover this stuff and really not look at some of the failures that have happened beforehand. So I think that's where we should kind of start. There have been a lot of failures policy-wise when it comes to these fires? We've looked at, if we just look at the most recent case of Hawaii, there we have, you know, beautiful green lush areas of Hawaii. In this particular island of Maui, we had all of this sort of shrubbery that had built up over years. There used to be sugar plantations, there used to be all kinds of pineapple plantations. You had no management of that area, and essentially you just had all of this dry heaved, you had all these trees, you had all this brush that had dried up that was just sitting there, and it was just fuel. And as soon as you had one electrical line that went down, it sparked it and went crazy. And we kind of, when we analyze this, looking at forest management and wildfires, you know, we say that is actually something that has been caused by human error, not just a line falling down, but you have not taken care of getting that fuel out of the way. And this is not something new. It's not some fringe theory. This is part of normal forest science, and it has been for something like 80 years. You need to have prescribed burns, burn certain parts of the forest, make sure there's no extra brush so that these huge fires can't break out. And unfortunately, we've had a lot of policies that have been reversed, both in Hawaii, California, and also in Western Canada, that have really allowed these fires to burn much hotter, much brighter, and to carry on much longer than they probably should have.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's really strange because I think, you know, I went to college at Humboldt State University in Northern California. They had one of the best forestry departments, you know, that I know, at least at the time in the 90s, one of the best departments in the state. And you also, if you know any ranchers, farmers, often landowners, this is, you know, land management going back hundreds of years, generations in some cases. I mean, how did I guess it's a little bit rhetorical, but I'd like to hear your take, because how did the academics and the politicians and those moneyed interests in this sort of, you know, green agenda, how were they able to reverse the lessons learned of, you know, generations of land management?
So you had kind of two events. The first event that is the most recent was the pandemic. And you had a lot of people who were monitoring the quality of the air in various cities, and particularly out west in the U.S. So the U.S. Forest Service sort of put out a warning, and they said, okay, guys, we're not going to do any more prescribed burns in Oregon, in Washington, in California. We think that more presence of smoke in the air will make it more harmful for those who could get coronavirus and, you know, fill in the blank. So there is kind of this pandemic angle very early on. They didn't really rescind that order really until the end of the year. So it really meant that there was so much extra brush that had collected up in all of these places. Obviously, you had less rain as well. So it was just basically a powder keg ready to go. That's one. Number two is you've had increasing environmental groups. These are groups like the Sierra Club and others. And they've actually been opposed to a lot of forest management for the climate goal reasons. They don't like that there's smoke. They don't like that there's fire. They don't like that some forests are being burnt down. But, you know, as you very well stated, you know, this is part of normal forest management. We need to do these prescribed burns to protect the rest of the forest, the land where people might live, where we might have agricultural fields. This is something that farmers do, as you stated as well. If you think of like sugarcane, you know, they have to burn certain parts of that in order to have the new harvest. And they do that in the Forestry Service as well. And in Canada, it's been the environmental groups. They've been going on and on about emissions of logging companies and using very much the same arguments that you've had elsewhere. I think it's where you've had this debate about what are our climate goals? What can we do? And that's sort of taken precedence over a very storied science of forest management, which is very unfortunate because really there's no expert in the world that's going against this.
Yeah. And maybe you've come across this, or maybe you can fill me in. I keep trying to get a hold of actual firefighters, you know, like I got a contact for a fire chief here or there or whatever. And I'm almost always told by that industry of first responders that they can't do media, they can't talk about. Have you come across this? Is there like a gag order kind of on the people that know maybe the most about this?
I wouldn't say it's a gag order. That's probably just the normal departmental rules. You know, you only have your sort of public officer who'll speak to media or, you know, have things. So it's the best thing to do is research, going into the bars, meet people, kind of get the lowdown. You know, and a lot of this is, yeah, there's a lot of these state rules. There are some of these actions, but also from the federal government. Obviously, we got to put blame on them a little bit. So the EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, they kind of came out with these new standards of what is the air quality supposed to be around the country. And they look at something called fine particulate matter, and it's a certain level. They say 2.5, nothing should go above that. We don't need to know the details. It's just that they've set a limit. And actually, that air quality, anytime you do a prescribed burn, it blows through that, obviously. And that is something that the EPA has been very stern on and is right now part of the regulations. So technically, if you're doing these prescribed burns and in a particular area you worsen the air quality, you're subject to fines, whether you be a local fire department or you're a forestry company, or you would have perhaps, you know, different proceedings against you. There's actually an entire delegation of California congressmen, left and right, Democrats, Republicans, who've written to try to repeal that because it's lunacy and they know that. But really, right now, we haven't really had much change from EPA. So you've had a lot of the diktats from Washington, D.C. that have been telling Western states how they should run their forests. We've kind of seen the damage that has done in the last couple of months.
Yeah, we really have. And the EPA recently just got, I'm blanking on the name of the case right now, but they just lost a case in Supreme Court. It's kind of similar, reminded me to like the ATF cases, you know, where they're basically saying you're a regulatory agency, you don't get to make legislation. Is the Supreme Court having an effect in this regard, or is the EPA still going to be running roughshod and sticking to their line here? Which, by the way, you'd think they would have learned something by now that, hey, if you don't like particulate matter, if you don't like smoke and fire, maybe don't let the whole forest turn into a tinderbox.
Man, you, I'm a policy analyst and a writer, and you hit the bone exactly where it should be hit. This is, I think, one of the most important cases that will be before our Supreme Court. What you're talking about is, it was actually the EPA versus Chevron. Yes. And they created something called the Chevron deference. And this idea was that, well, you know, things are very complicated. We'll leave it up to the experts in the agencies to figure out what should be the finer rules of regulations. Well, you know, we've had this standing now for about 30 or 40 years, and we kind of see the impact of that. Our federal agencies have more power than ever before. If you look at FCC, FTC, SEC, EPA, and they're able to come up with rules that Congress never gave them the right to do. So there's actually a fisheries case that will be using this whole Chevron deference that will be back at the Supreme Court. So it is right now on the bench. They should rule on it either, we think, by the end of the year or in the first quarter of next year. And it will revisit the power of these agencies to set these kind of rules without actual congressional approval. I think that is something that's really necessary because a lot of this stuff has gone out of whack. I mean, I happen to cover a lot of different areas and I can see it, but I think everyone has at least one story of something that they're interested in or an industry or some regulations that impact them, that a lot of these agencies have just kind of gone wild. And they don't really have the remit of Congress and by extension, the people. We'll see what happens with the Supreme Court, but I'm excited for that. And I'm glad you brought that one up.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Me too. I mean, the Supreme Court really, I mean, they're not perfect, but they've been a little bit of a light at the end of the tunnel in the last 18 months or so, you know, with across multiple you know, fields of interest and politics. So I'm keenly interested to see, because this one, I think this is one of those precedent setting sort of things, because it really seems like, because we're talking about NGOs, we're talking about regulatory agencies, you just rattled off a whole bunch of them. If we went through every single one of those and said, now, wait a minute, this regulation is not congressionally approved and there's litigation happening on it. There are people losing money, businesses losing money, business opportunities not happening, and giant fires happening, you know, in this case. So, I mean, I really hope that that becomes something that you can utilize in the toolkit here.
Yeah. And, you know, I can think of like a dozen examples off the top of my head of where this is happening. You have everything related to crypto policy with the SEC, everything that's happening there. You have the legalization of cannabis federally, which we're still waiting on, which is right now with DEA, and they need to revise something. You have everything that's happening with lawsuits against Amazon and Google from FTC. You got the FCC that wants to re-regulate the internet as a public utility. This is all happening at once. Obviously, there is a center around the executive office and the president, so we know where a lot of those ideas are coming from. But the agencies are empowered more than before. And it, you know, the thing that you always have to remember with these agencies is once you give them that power, when your guy's not there, they still have the same power. And I think that's what we really need to, you know, impart upon a lot of these activists and people who are discussing these issues or having influence, is once you give them that power, the pendulum can always swing back.
It's such an important point, you know, because that's what happens when we get polarized, hyper polarized over power politics the way that we are. And it's, you know, it used to be like power politics entailed a lot. But now it entails everything. It entails like bathrooms in schools. It, you know, entails whether a farmer can do his normal prescribed burn that, you know, his father and his grandfather and his great grandfather have done, you know, annually in the same place. So it's what do you have to say about the green agenda, the Green New Deal, all this stuff? Because it really feels like they are trying to scare us. They're telling little kids that we won't have a planet in 12 years if they don't become activists for the planet. But, you know, it's been totally used. And nobody wants a bad planet. Nobody wants a dirty planet. No one wants the planet to die, except maybe, I don't know, China and the DOD, who just pollute like crazy. But I'll set that aside. But what do you think about the larger agenda at play?
Well, I think if you just have to look at what they propose as solutions. And if we look at the climate solutions right now, the number one plan is electrification of absolutely everything, whether it's your car or the heat pump in your house. And there's zero analysis about the grid or where we get those gigawatts. And what we've seen is that a number of states are very opposed to certain types of power or energy. And not everything is going to be run by solar or wind unless there are billions more in subsidies that allow that to come in. You know, there's been a great success of basically the nuclear industry that's come in and actually offered. I did a lot of research the last couple of weeks. You know, you have states like South Carolina and Illinois. These states are already technically carbon neutral because they all run over 50% of their electricity from nuclear. They export it to other states. You know, you never hear them talked about as climate champions or something like this. You know, it's always California or New York, but a lot of these states are doing the work and, you know, they're actually relying on good, dense energy. And I think that's where a lot of this stuff falls apart because, you know, everyone can talk about going net zero by 2030 or 2040, but how are you going to get there? Are you going to mine more rare earth minerals out of China so that we can build the batteries? Or are you talking about actually deploying new nuclear power stations are relying on geothermal power or fracking for gas, where we can actually do that cheaply in the United States? We don't really have any kind of answers to that. So again, I always look at the solutions that are offered. There are already better ways to do this. Sometimes they're just not politically convenient, or perhaps they're not giving to the right party.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. That's very well said. And what do you think about the way that the state government and the federal government are responding to the people in Maui and in Lahaina? How do you feel about the sort of the aftermath of all that?
Yeah, I mean, I followed some of the details. I know that, you know, there's some payouts and things. You know, it's always very difficult with natural disasters. I'm more familiar with Florida, having lived there and followed a lot of the insurance fund. You know, there's a lot of money that was poured into this, and it was basically raided every single year. And that's kind of what happens, is we create these moral hazard insurance schemes that the government runs. It'd be much better if we had a lot more private insurance, property insurance, that were able to take care of that. A lot of times we've had to subsidize that through either the state or the federal government. And I think that's where we just have too much money that's on the line, things that are being thrown around. So it's obviously devastating for the people of Hawaii. I think there's a lot of blame, again, going back to prescribed burns and good forest management and land management. Things that they easily could have done that many industries warned them about. And because they abandoned that, many people's homes are now charred and don't exist anymore. So I think there has to be some kind of accountability as well. We often forget that. It kind of gets skipped, and we mostly talk about money and relief. You know, it hasn't been run great so far. You know, it's very difficult to deal with natural disasters. It's not always perfect. I hope there would be a better solution, but I think the better thing to do is actually study the good old scientifically based practices that have stopped this in so many different areas that we don't have to deal with anymore.
Very well said, my friend. Very well said. OCRegister.com. That's the Orange County Register. That is one place you can find our guest, Yale Osowski's writings. Yale, thank you very much for joining us. It was a great conversation. I feel like I learned a lot, and I'll look forward to having you back on again. I'm afraid we haven't seen the end of crazy wildfires.
Absolutely. Thanks so much, huh?
Okay, thank you. Once again, OCRegister.com. You're listening to today's News Talk, TNT Radio.